Hello, and welcome to Say Yes to NMES. I'm your host, Craig Mateer. Thanks for tuning in, and welcome to the podcast where we highlight and celebrate the success that NMES has had in the treatment of dysphagia. Today I'm joined by Tina Mastrangelo, and she'll tell us about one of her early patients that just wanted to have a little bit on the golf course with his buddies. Listen to his story and how Tina made that happen. Tell me your name and a little bit about yourself.
Okay, hi, my name is Tina Mastrangelo, and I've been a speech pathologist for 32 years. I graduated from Auburn University, and at the end of my master's, I walked into an inpatient rehab hospital and fell in love with the population. Worked at Encompass Health for 3 or 4 years, and then we contracted with an acute care hospital, so then I did some acute care for about 4 years, and then started doing home health on the side for 10 years. And so I have a base of knowledge, which I think has helped drive my knowledge base and my desire to learn more, knowing that there is more, and it's not just what you see bedside, but it's also the families, and it's also taking into account that we can't stop learning because your patients don't benefit when you stop. So when VitalSTEM came along, I was very excited because it was a time when we had inpatient and outpatient at that time. And so I started doing swallowing treatment like at 7:30 in the morning, back to back. And patients were just hearing about electrical stimulation. And so we were getting a lot of patients. And so I was seeing, you know, everything from stroke to brain injury to heart, you know, just every diagnosis. And I just found it worked. And so kept using it.
And how long have you been doing NMES or VitalSTEM?
So I started, Marcy had just done all the research. And so we started here in 2005 using VitalSTEM.
And how did you first get involved or first hear about it? Or why did you get involved with VitalSTEM?
We were constantly looking for, you know, what's cutting edge, what can our patients do more, what can, you know, where can we go? We do our own modified Behring Small study, so it's like we know enough about muscles to know that, you know, exercise is great, but if there's something else. So when the research came out, we started reading the research, started talking to our doctors, started talking to our respiratory therapists, started talking to everyone in the community, and just doing our research and found validation. And then when we started using it, we saw the validation.
Tell me a little bit about the inpatient facility and what's involved there.
So the inpatient facility, and I've actually been here for 32 years, we just contracted out with acute care and then home health I was doing on the side, so the exposure. But in an inpatient rehab, we have patients who come in for, let's say, 2 weeks. For patients who have come out of acute care generally or long-term care, who have not blossomed and been able to go home, and we take that opportunity with doctors oversight, including a hospitalist and a physical medicine and rehabilitation physician, and 15 hours of therapy and a case manager involvement. Respiratory is needed, pharmacy is needed, and through that interdisciplinary and holistic view of the patient with families involved as much as we can get them involved, then we target those patients to hopefully go home and to go home at a significantly higher functional level than when they came to us.
That's fantastic. And tell me a little bit about the case you're going to highlight today.
So I want to tell you about one of my first cases, because there will, in the beginning, you hear all these things and you see results, but sometimes you go, you know, is it the exercise? Is it this? Is it that? And as much research as you have, it's still nice just to know without a doubt. So this patient had been referred to me. He was an outpatient, young man, you know, early 60s, and he came out of another acute care hospital right near us. He was an outpatient, and he had worked on his swallowing. He had done everything. One of the speech pathologists who was treating him is a good friend of mine. I'm like, She goes, Tina, I'm sending this patient to you because I can't do anymore. I said, what have you been doing? And we talked through effortful swallows, and we talked through endurance, and we talked through Mendelsohn's and head adjustments and every single thing either of us knew. And she's like, I've treated him, I've reevaluated him, I've treated him, I've done another swallow study, and he's just not getting better. If you've got something you think will work. And I said, I don't know, send him to me. So this man came to me. He was fully independent, walked in the door. His goal was to be able, he was already back on the golf course, golfing with his peg. And heartbreak for him is he couldn't go out with his buddies on the break because he had to go, you know, do bolus feeding and had to go home. And so that was his goal for swallowing, is just to be able to sit down and, in his words, you know, just have a little bit with his friends so that he could return to a full quality of life.
He was tube feeding, is that correct?
Full tube feed.
Okay, and tell me exactly how that works for the people listening that might not know exactly what that entails.
Okay, so for some patients, depending on their diagnosis, whether it be cancer, it be neuropatients, or whatever's going on with them, they are unable to swallow safely. So the pipes that go into the lungs and the pipes that go into the stomach are right beside each other. And if there's any discoordination, if there's any weakness, if there's any timing that's off, you know, we all do it. You know, you take a sip of water and it goes down the wrong way. But these patients do it frequently enough that it can lead to temperature. It can lead to pneumonia. It can lead to weakness, discoordination, falls. I mean, you name it. And so these patients are unsafe to put something in their mouth, whether it be food, whether it be liquid. And so then they have to have some way of providing nutrition and hydration to the body. So the doctors will put in a small tube, pretty much the size of maybe a large pin, and it goes directly into the stomach, and then it opens up, and you can either attach it to an IV pole and bag, where they're attached to that overnight or during the day, or you can use it and just pour a can into the stomach very slowly. And so it avoids the mouth, it avoids the throat, it avoids the esophagus going straight into the stomach. And then you close the tube off, and, you know, some people can go on with their day and live a quite normal life. And then some people are very just dependent on that tube because it's all there is, you know. I have to be fed, I have to be fed. And then sometimes that will prevent the risk of pneumonia. And then some of the research in our field says that it won't prevent it. And when you lay down, you know, it backs up and it can go into the lungs as well. So it's definitely a medical decision that very much for a lot of our patients, a quality of life decision. Some people want a tube, some people don't want to.
Yeah, the quality of life issue, and hopefully you'll be able to say a little bit more about this patient in particular, but from the outside world, he probably looked quote-unquote normal. But he certainly doesn't feel normal because he can't do the things that the rest of us, so much of what we consider to be normal, which is, you know, to have a drink or a snack or, you know, catch up at a lunch or meet for breakfast or whatever it might be, because even though everything else seems normal, that forces these dysphagia patients, into isolation, correct?
Yes, very much so. And the patients who cannot tolerate what we call bolus, you know, where they pour a can into the stomach, are literally attached to this pole. And so they can't go out with their families. And I mean, how many of us, that's the biggest thing, hey, so-and-so's coming into town, where are we going to eat? And they don't have that ability. So many of them, most of them, I would say, have some degree of isolation. And then fear of pneumonia is an ongoing, and with everything else going on in people's bodies these days, it's just a compounding factor that what if I get pneumonia? What if I get pneumonia? How do I do my tube feed? Oh, my wife has to do this. She can't do that. Oh, my husband, he wouldn't ever be able to do this. You know, we don't think about it in the medical field as, you know, having a little tube and just pouring something in it. But when you deal with people who are non-medical, it's scary. In our facility, we actually have signs up, and it's like, observe, hands-on competence, because it's not an easy thing and for anybody to do, but when you get to people who have tremors or who have shakes or who have arthritis, and all of a sudden they're having to hold a small tube and pour a can, it's tough for a lot of our patients. So anytime we can get a patient off of the tube feeding, you know, that's a huge success and a huge encouragement to quality of life at home.
Okay, so tell me, so now your friend has referred him over to you, and what happens from there?
So he came in, and like you said, he looked completely normal. I never would have known. There was no weakness in his mouth, obviously weakness in his throat. No real diagnosis for the dysphagia, except that all of a sudden he had gotten to where he could not swallow. He had medical testing, and there was no stroke diagnosed, no traumatic brain injury of any sort, so we did not know the diagnosis. And so he was sat down and said, whatever, you know. And so 4 weeks in, we did all the exercises that my other speech pathologist friend had been doing, the exact same exercises, except the only difference was that we were using vital stem. 4 weeks later, the swallow study was normal. 4 weeks later, he was able to go talk to his doctor, who was a little hesitant in the beginning, but and get his tube out, and he went back on the golf course and called me when they went out and had a meal on the golf course because he was so excited. So that was not the first time I had seen results, but it was the first time where that was the only differential. Because I did the same exact thing that she had done, except for vital stem.
And tell me a little bit, if you can remember that conversation from him. What did he say? How did he feel? What can you share?
It was a while back, but all I remember is him being so excited that he had his life back. So excited that even though he had been on the golf course, now he didn't have to be the one that was left out to go home, and pour a can of food in his stomach. He was the one who could fit back in. That's what I remember most, is the emotional part of it.
That's fantastic. So what did that, and you've probably alluded to it some already, but what did that example, and I'm sure the numerous examples you've had since then, what has that kind of shown you about, vital stem and NMES and in the treatment of dysphagia, and what's your kind of what I would say the overarching view of all of it?
So my overall view moving from that point is there were so many patients that, they would come in, they had been told there's nothing else for you. There's nothing else we can do. You're never going to eat again. You're never going to drink again. And it just became, I don't want to say a joke, because it's never a joke when you're talking about someone's life, but they would come in and I'd say, I don't care what anybody else has told you. Let's just get to work. And within like a week or two, it was just over and over and over again. And then I had a friend and her husband had base of tongue cancer and he couldn't swallow. And we started using vital stem. And then I learned, you need to send them to physical therapy and the movements of the neck and, loosening things up before you put vital stem on, and then the respiratory component if you can find the airway protection. And there's just so much more. But I think if people use everything in their bag and never accept the fact that as long as there's a systemic reserve, and by that I mean, as long as the patient has the capability within his blood system and his breathing system to gain strength and gain coordination and gain endurance, then they have to be given that chance. And if they're ready to fight for it, you have to have vital stem. You have to have all the respiratory measures. You have to give them that chance if you're going to change change the world.
Yeah. And you therapists are changing the world. And I come from an engineering background, and I just think of, you know, the difference that all the SLPs out there doing this are having on their patients and the families of their patients. 'Cause it goes beyond them. It goes, you know, like you said, it spreads everywhere.
It does. And, you know, that's the fight. It's just not being mediocre. It's wanting more for your patients and more for your families. And then, well, going back to the patients that I've seen, they were all committed. I mean, they worked and swallowed and swallowed and swallowed and swallowed and swallowed. You know, so it's not necessarily about everything that we do, but it's about the patients who truly want to live again and want that quality of life.
Oh,
and sometimes that quality of life is just an ice chip, you know, but the ice chip's worth it.
Right. Right. But I do think, and I know this is not against anyone else, but I think of those people that have been told, oh, you'll never eat again. And what that statement would feel like to, you know, to be told that and then to be wrong about it, you know, to whatever, however many days or however many weeks or however many years that they thought the person that said, oh, you'll never eat again was right, to find out that someone like you can change that opinion, you know?
And this is one of my horrible stories, but you go back to a lot of it is just lack of education. When I started out, I remember doing a swallow study with an oncology patient, and she and her husband came in, and this was way before Vital Stim and way before I knew a lot that I know now, but did her swallow study. She's grossly aspirated, and I sat down in counseling after the swallow study, and I said, you can't. You don't need to be doing anything. You're going to put yourself in a situation where you can put yourself in the hospital, and look how well you're doing. Well, her well was, she was walking around pretty independently. She had gotten through her chemotherapy. She was swimming 10 and 20 laps every single morning in a pool. And thinking back now, I mean, I cried after that conference. It was horrible to tell somebody you can't have, you know, that one little bit of ice cream that you want when you sit down with your husband in the evenings. I mean, this woman had the respiratory capabilities, you know, to do 20 laps. And her lungs were clear. So it's crazy that I told her that. But it wasn't that I wanted to. It was that I did not know at that point what to do. Today, it'd be a whole different story.
That's fantastic.
I tell anyone that I have that comes through my path, if they have not been to one of your courses, that they need to go, because I feel like you guys, from the very beginning, have increased, when there weren't even dysphagia courses being offered in all the universities, you guys have raised the level of swallowing in the community in general. And then, you know, that helps me too, because some of your administrative staff also have friends who got me into NDT and the myofascial, and those are just other areas that I think help the swallowing and everything else. So I appreciate you guys.
Well, Tina, thank you so much for joining me today and sharing those wonderful stories with us. And I look forward to talking to you again soon.
You too. Thanks so much, Greg.
Thank you for listening. And remember, if you have an NMES success story you would like to share, contact me at craig@chaoseminars.com. That's craig@CIAOseminars.com. We'd love to have you on the podcast. Ciao.